ஸ்ரீ அன்னை பகவான் ஸ்ரீ அரவிந்தர் அப்பா தவ திரு கர்மயோகி அவர்களின் பாதார விந்தங்களில் பணிந்து இன்றைய வெப் மீட்டிங் நிகழ்ச்சியை துவங்குகிறோம். இங்கு டாபிக் அவுட் ஆஃப் தி செவன் போல்ட் இக்னரன்ஸ் டுவர்ட்ஸ் தி செவன் போல்ட் நாலேஜ் கேரி சார் அவர்கள் பேச இருக்கிறார்கள். ஐ எம் நவ் இன்வைட்டிங் மிஸ்டர் கேரி டு டாக் தி ஸ்டார்ட் தி டாக்.
George Bernard Shaw wrote a story, maybe it's almost 100 years ago, called Pygmalion. And it was made into a Broadway play and a movie called My Fair Lady. Some of you know the story, I think. In the story, a poor, uneducated flower girl selling flowers in London named Eliza Doolittle is found by a professor, a very famous professor of linguistics and phonetics, the pronunciation of language, named Henry Higgins, who's such an expert in English language and pronunciation that if he hears an Englishman or anybody speaking English, he can tell exactly not only what country they come from, but if he's an Englishman, he can tell him what city he comes from. If he's a Londoner, he can tell from what part of London he comes from and which class of society he's from. He's so proud of his knowledge about phonetics. There's an English Army Colonel, Pickering, who comes all the way from India to meet Professor Higgins to study and find out about his great knowledge. And they meet at a bus. They're waiting outside a theater, and Higgins hears Eliza calling out trying to sell flowers in her slang voice and pronunciation, and he boasts to Colonel Pickering, "Why, I could take a flower girl like that and teach her in 6 months how to speak like a princess." And Pickering is so impressed by this man's great knowledge that he offers to pay for the whole experiment, and they persuade Eliza, take her home, and for 6 months Higgins puts her through such a rigorous training. And at the end of 6 months, he takes her, of course, they're not only teaching her to speak, they're teaching her how to dress, how to walk, how to behave. At the end of 6 months, he takes her to a ball where there are very famous aristocratic English society and introduces her as somebody from a distinguished family. And everyone who meets her and the prince who danced with her, everybody's carried away by the grace of this young woman who seems to be of such aristocratic basis. But there's one person in the group who's suspicious. There's an old student of Professor Higgins who has studied under him, and he comes forward and he says, "This girl is a fraud. She's not a member of the English aristocracy at all. She's a Hungarian princess of royal blood." He thinks he's so clever because he has found out the secret. For Higgins and Pickering, this is the greatest triumph of their life because he has proven beyond doubt that he could do what he said. And they go home, and Higgins and Pickering are just celebrating gloriously, and Higgins is feeling so triumphant, and Pickering is complimenting him, praising him on his great knowledge. Nobody has the knowledge that you have. You have a consummate, you have proven yourself, you have excelled everything. Eliza is sitting there all the time. They're not even looking at her. They're not talking to her. They don't take into account what she has done in 6 months to become mistaken for a Hungarian princess. And finally, at the end, they decide they're tired. They're going to go up to bed, and as he's leaving the room, he stops and he said, "What did I do with my slippers?" And he turns around, the slippers are sitting next to where Eliza is. She picks them up and she throws them at him. This is the response to his consummate knowledge. What is the knowledge he had? And he's bewildered and surprised. "What, Eliza, what's wrong with you? Why you're not celebrating?" His knowledge is a glorified form of ignorance. In Book 2, Part 1, we spent a long time, Sri Aurobindo spent a long time talking to us, explaining in great detail how the infinite consciousness becomes the ignorance that we see as the world around us. And in Book 2, Part 2, he calls it knowledge and spiritual evolution. He's explaining how the ignorance is evolving spiritually to knowledge. In fact, to life divine. In the previous part, one, he talked to us about the sevenfold ignorance. We had long discussions trying to understand what does he really mean by ignorance and what are all the ways in which we are ignorant of the truth, of the reality, and he's identified it under seven different levels. He said, first of all, we're ignorant of the ultimate reality. This is not, of course, first of all, this is last of all. But if you want to start, we don't know what the ultimate reality is, which can be called Brahman or the Absolute or by whatever name we want. Secondly, we're ignorant of what's beyond the cosmos, what we call God or divinity. We live in a world, we're ignorant that there's something beyond the universe, beyond the world. He calls it the cosmic ignorance. We are also ignorant in time. We live in time, we live in the moment. We're ignorant of our past births and future births. We're ignorant, more importantly than that, that the truth of our existence is eternal, that we're eternal beings. We live in the moment and worry about how much time do I have left for my work today or for my life before it's over. We don't realize that the truth of our being is it's a timeless, immortal being. It's our temporal ignorance. We're ignorant of our oneness with other people, with our relation with other people, with the relation with the world around us. We think of, it's me, it's you. I'm separate, you're separate. We're in the egoistic ignorance that separates us from everybody else. We're ignorant of the fullness of our own being, the truth of our own being. We live right on the surface, superficial, shallow surface, like the dot on the edge of a balloon, unaware of the huge being that we are, subconscious, superconscious, subliminal being that we are. And even on the surface, like the characters in Pride and Prejudice who we refer to so much, even in our surface we're ignorant of what's going on. Our thought mind doesn't understand what our emotions are feeling, what our vitality is feeling. Our body has different urges. We're divided within ourself at all levels. And these six forms of ignorance result in what he calls the practical ignorance, which means I don't know what to do right now to get what I want, to get results. We think our problem is, I don't know what to do right now to turn on the computer and make it work and get it to work properly, or to get somebody, or Darcy doesn't know what to do to get Elizabeth to accept his proposal, or Mrs. Bennett doesn't know what to do to get 3-5 daughters married. She thinks it's all a practical question. We have to figure it out. We maybe should read some books on marriage or proposing or fixing the computer or whatever it is. We think our problem is practical. But what he's actually told us is, as long as these other 6 levels of ignorance are there, you will never have full mastery at the practical level. Because to have full knowledge at the practical level and full mastery at the practical level means to be capable of perfection, means life is divine, means there's no more error, there's no more falsehood, there's no more suffering, there's no more evil. Everything you do will be a perfect success. Everything you conceive will become a reality. For that, which is our, every human being aspires, we want the practical results. We want to get what we want. But we try to do it at the practical level, like Mrs. Bennett. She sends Jane on horseback to Netherfield, hoping that it will rain. So Jane has to spend the night there. She'll meet Bingley. She'll get proposed. She's trying to solve things way at this end, where the whole thrust of this book is that the practical ignorance will only be overcome when we move from sevenfold ignorance to sevenfold knowledge. And that's what the rest of the book is about. We're 2/3 of the way through the book in terms of pages. We're more than 3/4 through in terms of chapters. The rest of these chapters go through and tell us step by step what the process of spiritual evolution is, not only for us as individuals, but for the universe, for humanity, for the universe, for the world really to become life divine. In the previous chapter, he talked to us about how the ignorance is created. Because when we understand how the ignorance is created, it will become clear to us what we need to do to come out of the ignorance. And that process of the ignorance being created is what he calls involution. We spent a long time on it. The one, the infinite, the divine, the absolute, the Brahman by whatever name, has become the many, has become the universe. The universe is not a mistake, it's not an error, it's not a miscalculation, it's not a maya, it's not an illusion, it's not hell from which we're trying to get to heaven. The universe is a manifestation of the one. All this is Brahman. But it's clearly not Brahman in the way that we imagine it. Not Brahman in its glorious perfection of divinity. It's Brahman manifesting as the ignorance. So he's explained to us in great detail how the one has become the many, how the truth has manifested as falsehood, darkness, evil, ignorance, error, so that when we fully know that process, we will understand at each step how do we reverse it, how do we move back. And of course, he's not talking about moving back. He says the goal is not to go back to the unmanifest oneness. If that were the goal, why start this thing in the first place? It's just a merry-go-round. Why should the divine have become the universe if the goal is simply to go to moksha and escape from that? Who needs it? It certainly doesn't need it. It was whole and complete to begin with. We can't attribute a mistake to it. It can't be just a bad dream. There must be a truth in it and a destiny in it. And he in fact explains to us that the destiny of the universe, the spiritual evolution he's talking about, is not our evolution. We are so self-centered, we think everything should be for us. The spiritual evolution is for the spirit. It is the divine that's manifesting itself and evolving to manifest in a universe all that it is now infinitely in its potential or in the unmanifest. So he explains to us what is that process by which the one has become the many, which he calls involution. We spent a long time on it. I just wanted to review it quickly because now we're going to reverse the direction and see how this all ties together. First thing he says is, he says by a process of self-conception, obviously not what we mean by self-conception when we're thinking, but by a process of self-conception, the infinite one conceives of what it wants to manifest, conceives of the forms it wants to create in a universe. And that is the power that he calls supermind, is the spirit's capacity for self-conception and creation of one as many. That is the power by which Brahman projects itself. What does Brahman create the universe out of? Creates it out of itself. How does it create it out of itself when it is everything, when it is all? It becomes an object to its own perception. And to understand this, we discussed the analogy of imagine Jane Austen writing a story, writing Pride and Prejudice. How does she do that? How does an author create a story? Out of her own consciousness, out of that knowledge in her own creative imagination, she conceives of characters, events, story, and she objectifies it. She objectifies it to the point that she herself can experience the story as if she's outside it. That the story exists even 200 years after she exists. And in his book on the Upanishads, Sri Aurobindo writes about Shakespeare's characters, or the famous characters of the Greek classics that were conceived 2,000 years ago, who apparently never existed. You think Hamlet never existed or Achilles never existed, but these characters have changed and inspired societies, inspired the world, changed the world. They exist in our minds, they exist in our emotions, they have existed and had practical impact. How many soldiers for the last 2,000 years have wished to be the next Achilles, who's invulnerable, who can conquer any enemy? They don't exist, they have not existed physically, because Brahman is the only power with the capacity to create even material form. So this process of self-conception, Brahman becomes an object to its own perception because there's nobody else but Brahman. There's nobody else to experience the universe but Brahman itself. But he doesn't stop there. He also has a capacity for self-limitation, to divide these many infinite variety of forms that it conceives and give them each an apparently separate existence. So when Jane Austen wrote Pride and Prejudice, she creates a character like Elizabeth Bennet or Jane or Darcy or Wickham or Collins or Mrs. Bennet, who each appear to be completely having their own identity and separate existence. Whereas in fact we know they only exist in her mind, in her creative consciousness. They are one within her consciousness, but in the world, to themselves, to each other, even to us, they seem like separate, real separate characters. And this capacity for self-limitation is the power of mind. Not just the power of our thinking mind, which is a very small, feeble expression of this, that reflects it, but the capacity of cosmic mind to create separate forms that appear to be independent of one another. And mind divides the one from the many, God from its creation, divides us from the divine, makes us feel separate from the divine, So Sri Aurobindo says, why do you want to worship the divine? You can become the divine because you are that in your essence. But mind makes us feel, where can I find the divine? How can I reach it? Where does it stay? Will it listen to me? Does Mother hear my prayers when I call? As if it's a second, somebody totally disconnected from us. Oh, Mother has forgotten me. She's abandoned me. That's mind that creates that gulf, that barrier between us. It's mind that separates our consciousness from the force, so that the divine that is conceived of the world and nature seem to be separate from one another. So separate that in many spiritual traditions they have taken the world as evil, or the world as some mistake, or the world as something opposite to the God, or in the case of science, has taken nature as just some mechanical force that's doing things in a random way or according to some fixed laws that nobody knows where they came from, but separate from consciousness. And it divides time and timelessness. It divides the finite from the infinite. So this is the power of mind for involution, for self-limitation. But it doesn't stop there. In order for ignorance really to be created, we not only have to limit ourselves, we have to forget who we are. Elizabeth Bennet has to forget that she's really Jane Austen. Each character has to forget its origin. Each character has to become so absorbed in what it's doing, what it is, that it forgets everything else. It's a process of self-absorption. Just like if I get angry, if I lose my temper about something, at that time I forget all that I've learned about be equal, be calm, be polite, what about peace, what about consecration, what about sincerity, what about, no. You have not given me what I want. I get absorbed in the action. I get absorbed in the force of my own sensations. I lost myself. I'm very sorry. I lost myself. I forgot myself. I literally forgot myself. Literally, we have all forgotten ourselves. We have gotten so absorbed in being who we think we are today, born here, living here, living in this house with this car or this job or this family, that we have forgotten who we really are. It's a process of self-absorption. And that process goes all the way down to creating the material forms in the universe, which are forms of matter, which he says are really forms of spirit in which the consciousness is involved. To add to all of that, we not only get involved in all of this and separated and limited by all this, absorbed in it all, but we think everything else in the universe, everyone else in the universe is separate than we are, which is the act of ego. I identify only with this part, not with the rest of me. So ego separates us not only from other people, but it separates us on the surface from all we are in the depths. We think that our identity is this little person who started here, who born here, lives here, got this education, has this job, has this possessions, has this relations, when in fact, as we will see and as we've discussed, we are something infinitely greater than that. And all of this put together results in what he calls the ignorance, which separates us from the entirety of our being and the integrality of our relationship with everything else, not only in the universe, but beyond universe. So this is how we got to where we are. Now we have to start the trip back. And he told us in the last chapter that the process of evolution, that's the involution, the process of evolution has certain fundamental principles to it. And at each stage of the evolution, from the very first emergence of life in matter, or animals in the living kingdom, or human life, and all the way to the final stages of spiritual evolution, the same principles are applicable, are expressing. And he said, the force, the divine force that has become universe has become so buried that the consciousness is fully concealed in the forms and in the force. So when the scientist looks at material objects, he says, this is inanimate. This is something without consciousness. Somehow out of those inanimate objects, animate life has come up. We don't know how. We call it a singularity. Oh, we have some explanation. Somehow out of this animate life, conscious forms have emerged. We don't know how. We don't know where that consciousness came from, though the neurologists, the neuroscientists try to explain to us that really our consciousness is only a question of electrical impulses and chemical reactions. Right? Yes, Ashok.
I would like to intervene now.
Okay.
If my understanding is correct, Sri Aurobindo seems to take the view that ignorance is the origin of evil.
Ignorance
is the origin of evil.
Yes.
If so, he seems to state that if mankind only recovers the sense of unity with the divine, that evil will disappear or something.
Yes.
But I am at a loss to understand how the recovering the sense of unity will lead to the abolition of evil itself, because evil, I think it exists in three forms: poverty, disease, and violence. Man recovers his sense of unity, he may give up violence and taste for warfare and all that. But I don't understand how recovering the sense of unity will in any way lead to elimination of poverty and disease, which are not directly related to the sense of unity. Poverty comes from material want, and disease comes from attack by germs. How are these things going to be affected by recovering the sense of unity?
Okay, so your question is, how can restoring the sense of unity abolish evil, when you really are asking, how can it abolish falsehood? How can it abolish poverty? How can it abolish incapacity? How can it abolish suffering? Which was the subject of the chapter that we had in part one. But what I can review briefly what he told us there. But evil is the easiest of these to explain. Because what is evil and what's the source of evil? The very primary impulse of evil is to hurt somebody else. No? When you have the knowledge of unity, you discover there is nobody else. There is nobody else. It's only the ego that perceives others as separate, as somebody to conquer, as somebody to compete with. When you really have the knowledge, say, we have built 70,000 nuclear weapons. To do what? Finally, we have recognized, in truth, I've talked to some of the people who were involved in building those weapons, who make the decisions in the U.S. government to build those weapons. Harlan Cleveland, who was the president of the World Academy, he was part of that. they realize that the only thing these weapons can do is destroy us. If we ever use these weapons, we'll be destroyed. They are unusable. So the whole origin of evil is thinking that I can gain by somebody else's suffering. No? That's based on the fact that I really think I'm separate from everybody else. The overcoming of the sevenfold ignorance, first of all, I'm giving you only a very small part of the explanation, because every part of the explanation explains why evil will be destroyed. Why would I have an impulse to hurt somebody else? Because I am lacking the one thing that we all crave for, which is full delight of existence. If I am filled with the delight of existence, my joy will be in identifying with everybody else. My joy will be in everyone else's joy, not in everyone else's suffering. Because I am suffering because I'm in the ignorance, I'm suffering because I'm cut off from myself, which he's going to tell us about, I'm cut off from other people, I'm cut off from the divine, which is the truth of my existence, I'm cut off from the Ananda, which is the fundamental principle of existence, and therefore, by some perverse means, I'm trying to gain a delight by somebody else suffering more than me. It's a perversity. When there's no capacity to suffer in us, there's no impulse for suffering anywhere else. And in fact, when there's no capacity for suffering in us, we take joy in everybody's joy, because not as a behavior, not as a philosophy, as a reality, we feel the joy that they feel, the way a parent feels the joy in the child's joy, which they feel physically identified with. For poverty and all the others, there's a similar answer, because poverty is based on incapacity or ignorance. There can be no ignorance and there can be no incapacity when we restore the oneness. Not the oneness of just going to moksha, the oneness that he's talking about, the integral oneness, the integral knowledge. It's the name of Srijit's institute, Integral Management, no? After Integral Knowledge. If you do that, it'll be wonderful. It is the knowledge to manifest perfection. When there's perfection, there cannot be poverty. There cannot be error. There cannot be suffering of any kind. So let's follow the stages of the evolution to sevenfold knowledge and see whether you still think, you come back at the end, see whether you still think that evil can persist if we come out of these seven stages. Okay?
Okay.
Anyway, fundamental question. Okay, so he says there is a process by which we ascend. The consciousness that has now become buried, hidden, lost from itself, whether it's in the material form or in us, it's buried in us too. An infinite consciousness, an infinite spiritual reality is buried in each of us. It has to come out. And he says there's a process for that. And we're going to look through the stages of that. And we discussed it last time. At each stage of the evolution, we have to rise to a higher level of consciousness. Rising to a higher level of consciousness, we have to then extend back to where we were, to the consciousness we are, and broaden it and elevate it by the power of that higher consciousness. And that's what we see that Elizabeth does after she reads Darcy's letter at Hunsford. She's lost in the vital consciousness. She's attached to her attraction to Wickham. She thought Darcy's a bad man. She's offended by his self-importance and his arrogance. She's fully in her emotions, the something we all know very well. When we get angry, when we get jealous, when we get bitter or something. What does she do? She reads the letter. She rises to the mental consciousness. And she looks down on her own behavior and her own life from that higher vantage point. And she says, I've been acting absurdly. I never knew myself until now. I never realized how blind I have been, how prejudiced I have been. And she reevaluates her whole life and her whole behavior from the higher point of view. It's mind. She happens to come to mind, not spirit. And then she goes and changes her attitudes and behaviors at the lower level to reflect the higher consciousness that's emerged. We all know this process. Occasionally we do it. Occasionally we have moments of rational clarity where we rise up out of the tug of war of personality, sensitivities, competitions, jealousies, whatever it is our baggage. And we feel we're breathing now. We can see. We can see over the horizon. We have a clarity. We have I got my head out of this, all of this. And then we go about reconstructing the lower to reflect our higher understanding, our higher vision. That same process we've all been through so many times is the process we're going to follow to go all the way till the seventh ignorance is dissolved. And that is the evolutionary process. And we'll come back to it at each stage. So let's start with the first ignorance, which he calls the constitutional ignorance. We've discussed it. It's the easiest one for us to identify and understand because it's where we are today. He calls it the crux of our ignorance. Unless we get out of this one, there's no question of overcoming the other six. This is where we start. What is that? How does he describe that crux? I want to read you a quote from Synthesis of Yoga, where he describes what we are. He's a poet, so he takes a little poetic freedom. He refers to us as the embarrassing multiplicity of our personality, the rich, endless confusion of nature. He says to the ordinary man who lives on his own waking surface, that's us, at least that's me, you guys speak for myself, his psychological existence is fairly simple. A small but clamorous company of desires, that's the vital. Some imperative intellectual and aesthetic cravings, that's the mind. A few ruling or prominent ideas amid a great current of unconnected or ill-connected and mostly trivial thoughts. Not very complimentary, but seems like an accurate description. A number of more or less imperative vital needs. A scattered and inconsequent succession of joys and griefs. Happy this minute, a little sad the next minute. Frequent minor disturbances. And rare stronger searchings and upheavals. All of this arranged by nature in some rough practical fashion. He calls it some tolerably ordered, disorderly order. Because I call myself a person. I think I'm one person, but I've got all of this stuff inside. When we go deep inside, we find ourselves surrounded by a whole complex world. That's the psychological ignorance, which we'll come to next. But he says, on the surface, each part of us, intellect, will, sense mind, nervous or desire self, heart, body, each has its own complex individuality, its own natural formation independent of the rest. This is the crux of the constitutional ignorance. And he goes a little further and he says, we not only have these three parts, mind, vital, physical, they're not only, each have their own personality, somewhat independent from the others, but we are stationed, we're stuck in the mud, we're grounded in the physical. Our highest faculty is the mental. But our mental faculty is distorted and limited, not by its capacity, but by the fact that we're stuck in the mud. We can't see what the mind sees. We see everything from the perspective of matter. Because we see through the senses, the mind is limited to believing, I will believe it when I see it. The physical things are real to us because the mind, capacity of mind is infinitely greater than the one we're using, but we use mind limited by the physical world. It's been conditioned over millions of years to believe that physical things are more real than the non-physical things. And if it says, prove it to me physically, then I will believe it. So this is the character of the constitutional ignorance, and in the story we've seen wonderful examples of this. Again, Elizabeth is the best. Darcy's a very good example when he goes and proposes to her at Hunsford. He really feels he can't live without her. He really feels, Elizabeth Bennet, you are the thing I need most in life. When he goes to propose to her, he ends up abusing her. Of course, you know, with your family, with your mother, with your sisters, you can understand I had severe reservations about proposing to you. What is it? The heart wants her. The mind itself feels it's wrong decision. Even now when he's proposing, he feels it's a wrong decision. He goes and proposes with the heart, and the mind interferes and tells you, I just want you to know I'm making a mistake. I know I'm making a mistake, I can't help myself. Meaning, my mind cannot prevent my heart from doing what it wants to do, but I keep telling it it's making a mistake. Not a very charming proposal, and we can understand the results that he got out of that. She threw it back in his face and said, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. Why did she say that? Because on the surface, her mind is equally offended by the offensiveness of his proposal. But we know later he's not the last man on earth she would ever marry. There's something else in her who would marry him, in fact, who will marry him. So clearly that point in her that said with great conviction, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry, was only a partial truth. It was a tiny little part on the surface that wasn't in connection with everything else. So this is the constitutional ignorance. If we don't get out of this, there's no hope for us on the others. It's this constitutional ignorance when she saw Wickham, when she tells Jane, any man who's this handsome must be true, must be good. She has allowed her vital attraction or her physical attraction to the man to completely override her mental judgment or her heart's judgment about what's a true person or a good person. If goodness is only what I like, if what looks pleasing to me, people who are nice to me, they're good people, that's by definition. That's the vital ruling our lives, not the mind. These are all expressions of the constitutional ignorance. And every character in the story exhibits their own version of the constitutional ignorance. When Charlotte proposes to, Collins proposes to Charlotte, and she comes and tells Lizzie that she's going to marry this fool because he's got £1,000 and he's got the entail on the property, Lizzie says, how could you possibly do that? How could you possibly marry a man like this just because he has property, just because he has respectability? What about romance? What about love? You couldn't possibly respect this man. He's a booby. She says, I'm not romantic. I'm not romantic. In fact, what she wants is a secure, safe home, meaning her mental decisions are guided by her physical concerns. At best, they're guided by vital concerns. And she's a very sensible woman in other respects. Maybe in the whole story, except for herself, she's the most sensible person in the story. Or Mrs. Gardner maybe is more sensible. But she's a level-headed, clear-headed girl. She sees from the beginning what should be done. But she's grounded in the physicality of her own life, and her whole life is skewed by that. So constitutional ignorance has many expressions. He says, getting out of the constitutional ignorance is the first step in our progress out of the human consciousness.
Getting?
Yes, Ashok.
I see a big difficulty in man getting out of what Sri Aurobindo calls the original ignorance. I mean by original ignorance is unawareness of his identity with the Supreme. What I said is that I see a big obstacle in the way of man getting rid of original ignorance.
You're up to original ignorance. We're still in constitutional ignorance.
You kind of moved one step.
You've moved seven steps, but okay.
I suppose by original ignorance, Sri Aurobindo means man's unawareness of his identity with the Supreme. Am I correct?
Yes, the absolute. It's the last, it's the second to last to go.
Yeah, I remember reading in Mother's Question and Answers, where she clearly said that our adoration must go to the Supreme only, and not to any of these gods. I suppose by God she means Hari, Shiva, Vishnu, Krishna, like that. But as far as I know, most people on earth are devoted only to some personal God, not to the Supreme, who remains a mere intellectual abstraction of the Hindu philosophers and Western philosophers. Even the monotheistic people, Christians worship God in the name of Jehovah only and not the Absolute. And Muslims worship God in the name of Allah. So how do you hope to wean humanity from worshipping personal God and turn the devotion to some intellectual abstraction? This is too much.
Of course, if anybody is foolish enough to give up God for an intellectual abstraction, they would really be foolish. First of all, I think our problem is even more serious than this, Ashok. So if we're going to put forth the problem in its full entirety, let's put it all on the table. Our problem is not that we worship gods. Our problem is we worship ourselves. Our problem is not that we don't believe in the absolute infinite Brahman. Our problem is we believe in the reality of matter. And that's alone real. Property is real. Money is real. Gold is real. Car is real. Our problem is much more serious than finding that there's something beyond the gods. And unless we start from where we are, we're not likely to encounter this difficulty. Like everything else in the universe, the gods are a power of the One, which have a role to have had a role to play in the creation up until now, and even in human evolution up until now. But if our goal is the divine life, worshiping the gods is not going to get us there. If our goal is to realize our true spiritual destiny, worshiping the gods will be a limit in that process. Sri Aurobindo never said that all humanity is going to overcome the original ignorance, just to be clear about that. He would like that. He has a hope or an aspiration for it. He also says, supposing humanity doesn't do it at all, then there's going to be another species that's going to come and do it. So he has not insisted that all of us must give up all our seven ignorances that we're very proud of and attached to, the gold chains that bind us. We have an opportunity. If we want the divine life, which, whether it's meant for humanity or not, it's definitely meant for the divine. the universe will definitely lead to divine life. Whether we're all to be part of it, whether all humanity is to be part of it, whether a new species has to come to do, like, as he said, we left the arboreal ape in the forest. The arboreal ape is our hereditary ancestor. If we had told the arboreal ape, he writes it in Life Divine, he said, if anybody had told the arboreal ape that you can be flying in the skies and shooting in rockets that the dev is made to go to the moon, or the satellites to go out to, or ships on the seas, or building skyscrapers in cities, what would the ape have made of all of this? I'm quite comfortable with my tree and coconuts and banana. Please don't bother me. We have our own trees and coconuts and bananas, and even the divine is not going to force us out of the forest if this is where we want to live. But we have that opportunity. And certainly the sure thing is, whether we do it or not, it's going to be done. It's an invitation he gives. You said that who's going to give up the gods for some intellectual conception of oneness? Absolutely right. Yesterday or the day before, we were reading a paper of Appa's on Life Divine, and he tells to read Life Divine as a philosophical statement of an intellectual truth. You know, Sri Aurobindo wasn't a philosopher at all. He considered himself a poet, but he was really a yogi. He's trying to reach us. The problem is, we are in the intellect, not he. He's not stationed in the intellect. He's trying to reach us. He said, Life Divine will really become real to us only when we get beyond the intellectual statement to the reality behind it. So, Appa has written frequently that what he wrote as an intellectual or philosophical statement in Life Divine, he has written as poetry, as mantra, in Savitri. And what he wrote as mantra in Savitri, Mother has written as lived experience in Agenda. He writes about divine love in Life Divine. He tells us at what point in our evolution divine love will become a real capacity in us, but it's just an information. It is just a flat, whether it's divine love or divine joy or divine oneness, they're all intellectual. But he has a line in Savitri about Mother where he says, love in her was wider than the universe. The whole world could take refuge in her single heart. Certainly, the person who can write that, or who can have that experience of Mother, that the whole world can take refuge in her single heart, has gone beyond the intellectual knowledge. But in Agenda, Mother describes what that experience of divine love is. She describes having had it for hours and at a time, And it's not like anything the mind can conceive. She says the whole universe becomes a wave of love. It's not a question of loving other people. The whole universe becomes, reveals itself as an ocean of love. And that is your being. And that she became that. She experienced that. And there was nothing else. And that's not a dream. That's a reality. And she didn't experience it in the intellect. She didn't experience it in her high spirit. She experienced it in her physical body. It was her physical body that became part of that ocean of love. Sri Aurobindo wrote a poem, a sonnet, maybe around the time he was writing Life Divine, or it's called The Bliss of Brahman. He says, I have become a snow-white sea of bliss. I have become a snow-white sea of bliss. Our goal is not to believe in bliss or believe in love. It's to become that. And anybody would be a fool to give up anything real to them just because of a philosophical intellectual statement. He doesn't want us to believe in a philosophy. He wants us to go for an experience. In order to go for that experience, in order to get out of that original ignorance, which Ashok is rightly pointing as the key, how can we do that as long as we're still feeling that that Charlotte has to marry Collins because she's never going to get another offer for marriage and she's never going to get the better than this foolish man, and having chickens in the backyard is a security for her. She's deeply wedded to the constitutional ignorance. There's no question of going beyond. So whatever the goal is, we have to start from where we are. It's a fundamental principle. We are in the constitutional ignorance. And he says the first step, which we're trying to make in half-hearted, is we have to become mental beings, really mental beings. We pride ourselves on our education, our intellect, and all, but we still are living in the constitutional ignorance grounded in the physical. We have to overcome the tyranny of the physicality and vitality, even on our mind, because for anybody to be rational really means we can't be influenced by what other people think. If you ask me my opinion about something, I say, well, this famous man said it, therefore I feel everybody agrees with this. I read it in the book. This is what everybody else says. If I say I don't believe in global warming, what, you idiot? You don't believe that? Thousands of scientists say there's global warming. Don't you? You must believe in it. Otherwise, thousands of scientists may be right about global warming, but my belief in global warming is not about global warming. It's my belief in thousands of scientists. If the thousands of scientists say it, it must be correct. It's not a rational statement that I know that global warming is a danger. It is a statement of my social conformity to everybody who says that global warming is a danger. So, what is it to be rational? What is it really to rise like Lizzie? That's why this story is so great, a silly love story about a few marriages. But in this story, the characters really make an evolutionary progress. When Lizzie rises to the point of looking at her own behavior and saying, I've been acting absurdly, I never knew myself till now, she's in the mind. How many times are we able to reach that peak and look back on our whole life and say, I've been acting absurdly, I never knew myself till now? It's not spirit. This is not spiritual. This is progress to the instrument we have developed, which has been given to us, which we treasure and worship and say it's so great. But how little of the time we really act rationally, free from what society is going to say, free from what other people are going to say about me, free from the vital interest of, if I say this, will I get a good job? If I tell the other person the truth, will my friends reject me? If I to confess what I'm really thinking, will anybody look at me anymore? Will I get my research post if I really tell them what I think about the professor of the department or about the what they're teaching here? Can I be rational? This is the first step. But he tells us quickly, being in mind is not enough. Being really rational has been an ideal of humanity for the last few hundred years. Maybe you can say somebody's ideal since the time of Socrates, and we know what happened to him for trying to be rational and speaking what he believed. He was given the hemlock and asked to commit suicide. But he said, even if we can be rational, even if Lizzie can do all the time what she did for a few minutes when she read Darcy's letter, mind, the power of mind by itself is not enough to shed even the constitutional ignorance. We have been using mind, religion has been using mind for thousands of years to control the vital, to control the physical. So, in all the monastic traditions, the devotee is told you give up sex, you give up property, whether you are you go and enter a monastery and pray all of the time. Mind can take that decision to be austere. It can control the vital. It can give away its money. I think, you know, it's much easier to give away money than to give up valuing money. It's much easier to shun the society than to give up the value of what the society is saying about me. If I can go to the forest and people will call me a great yogi, then it's good. At least I get the appreciation of the society by going away. So mind doesn't have the power to transform the vital or the physical. Mind cannot even rid us of ego. That's why in all the tradition, the great rishis who had great spiritual powers, they also would get angry and curse people for a very ordinary reason. Their realizations were realizations from mind, which has no capacity to destroy to dissolve the ego or transform the vital. At best, we can control it. Man has been trying to control the vital and the physical for thousands of years. We call it civilization, and you know how well we're doing. And if modern society is the measure of that, we're destroying the earth. We are overcome with greed of all descriptions and everything. It's not going to be done by the purely rational man, though if we were all purely rational people, we can congratulate ourselves that we have made a progress. But it's not enough. We have to go beyond. We have to overcome the constitutional ignorance. How do we do it? We've been talking about it. If you look at the characters in the story, it'll be so easy because we know them well. We know all of their weaknesses and their folly so well. What would you tell Darcy when he comes to the first dance and Bingley asks him to dance with Elizabeth and he says, yes, I want to come out of ignorance. What would you tell him? You tell him, don't say that this girl is only tolerable and you're not here to dance with the women who are neglected by other men. You're in the constitutional ignorance. What would you tell the Bingley who comes up to him and says, Darcy, don't be stupid standing around here? Anybody knows Darcy knows that you'll never get him to do anything by calling him stupid. In fact, very few people will do something because you call them stupid, but Darcy of all people won't, and certainly not if Bingley calls him stupid. Who's stupid here? If either of them is stupid, it's not Darcy. It's stupid to call him stupid. he's in the constitutional ignorance. When Lizzie says, any man that handsome must be good, we know where she is. When Darcy says, will you please marry me even though you're low and inferior and it's a great sacrifice for me, he's definitely in the constitutional ignorance. In fact, it's hard to find any character at any moment in the story. Maybe there are a few rare, beautiful moments that we treasure the story for, where we're not in the constitutional ignorance. Mother has her rules of psychic education. And if you look at the rules of psychic education, you can say these are really rules to overcome the constitutional ignorance. She says first, don't seek comfort. Well, not seek comfort. What's wrong with comfort? Comfort is good. Cool air, soft chair, nice bed. Comfort is good. Why not seek? She doesn't say discomfort is good. She doesn't say go and sleep on a bed of nails or sleep outside in the sun or something like that. The goal of your life should not be seeking comfort. Why? Comfort is of the physical. The animal seeks comfort. Comfort is the only thing it wants. It's hungry for a meal, it hunts for the meal, it barks, it fights for the meal. Once it gets the meal, what does it do? It looks for a shady place, it digs a hole in the ground like a dog, and it sleeps until the hunger comes back. Because life ends with the physical cycle of seeking comfort. So when seeking comfort is the goal of our life, we stop there. Her second rule is, she says, don't do what's of interest to you. Take interest in everything you do. What's wrong with doing what's interesting to me? I love to do what's interesting to me. For some people, it's to collect things or go shopping or read a book or something like that. What am I to do? What is the purpose of your life? Everything that comes to you has a role to play in your growth. If you think washing dishes is something that's not interesting, or teaching, taking care of the members of the family is not interesting, or it means we're missing whatever comes to us as a necessary experience for our progress. So she says, take interest in whatever you do, meaning whatever you have to do, whatever comes to you. I have met many CEOs of companies who... they do something. Some of them go out and spend their time in the workshop. Some of them are always doing the accounts. Different people are different types. They have their different things. Very often in companies, the CEO is doing what he likes to do, what he feels comfortable to do. And if you see the problems in the company, they're always in the areas where he refuses. I don't know about that. I never understood a balance sheet, that's why I have an accountant. And his company will never be profitable. If you are going to be a CEO, you have to take interest in people, you have to take interest in the customers, you can't just hire a salesman to go out there, you have to understand your technology, you have to understand people. You can't just have an HR person to take care of your people for you. You have to understand organization and how things go together. Wherever we're not willing to take interest, that's where our constitutional ignorance will show. There's only two rules of psychic education. She has 12. And then the third one is, don't have faith in the mind's externalized way of seeing, because it's a distorted view of reality. And we know enough examples of that. It doesn't mean we should be irrational. It doesn't mean we should neglect the information that... Don't judge things just by mind's summary conclusions about them. Darcy thought, see, this girl is in Meryton. Her mother was from the middle class. Nobody's dancing with her. So it's very clear, this is not a girl that I should be mixing with. What did he discover later? Nowhere in society, up to the highest society at St. James, nowhere has he met a girl like this. She may have only 50 pounds in her dowry. He has never met a human being with this individuality, this intelligence, this courage, this goodness for her sister, this liveliness that he needs. But he's responded from the external appearances and missed that deeper reality. So the first three rules of psychic education are enough for us to help us move out of the constitutional ignorance. And then there are only six more left, so we're making progress, right? Then he comes to the psychological ignorance. I'd like to read another passage from Synthesis. Inwardly, too, no less than outwardly, we are not alone in the world. The sharp separateness of our ego is no more than a delusion. We do not exist in ourselves. We do not really live apart in an inner privacy and solitude, which is what I feel. When I'm alone, when I go inside and consult myself, I feel like I'm in an inner privacy and solitude. He says it's an illusion, or it's rather a delusion. Our mind is a receiving, developing, and modifying machine. It's all the time receiving from the world around, from others. I think that what comes into my mind are my thoughts. I don't realize they're coming from the universal mind. I don't realize you have a thought, and I may be receiving it as my own. From every moment, things are passing into me. Not just thoughts are passing into me, impulses. Somebody's angry, I feel angry. Somebody's hungry, I may feel hungry. Somebody's irritated, I may feel irritated. Somebody's happy, I can feel happy. We think, I'm very happy. I'm very happy because I'm surrounded by happy people. We call it the atmosphere. There's an atmosphere. There's a rich atmosphere that uplifts us. Much more than half of our thoughts, I think he's being generous, only half. Much more than half of our thoughts and feelings are not our own, in the sense that they take form out of ourselves. Of hardly anything can it be said that it is truly original to our nature. This is my conviction. Where did I get it? Well, my father had that conviction. This is the way I do things. I believe in this. How do I believe in this? I was raised to believe it. I learned it in school. My family said it. My mother used to always tell me that. My grandfather was like that. What is my own? What can I claim as my own? The language is not my own. The thoughts are not my own. No ideas. How many can say I had an original idea that's not there before? Even when Copernicus came up with this crazy idea that the Earth is revolving around the Sun and not vice versa, it was an idea that was there 1,500 years earlier. It wasn't his original idea. A large part comes to us from others or from the environment. But still more largely, it comes from universal nature, here or even from other worlds and planes of existence and their beings and powers and influences. For we are overtopped and environed by other planes of consciousness, mind planes, life planes, subtle matter planes, from which our life and action are fed, or fed on, pressed, dominated, made use of, for the manifestation of their forms and forces. That's what Mother said about Hitler. Hitler was possessed by forces and beings from other plane to express their urge for destruction, for evil. The difficulty of our separate salvation is immensely increased by this complexity and manifold openness. If I want, everybody's got a problem, I'm going to look out for myself, I'm going for moksha. You can all take care of yourself, I'll see you at the other side if anybody sees anybody there. The difficulty is, if you want moksha, you can forget all of this because you want to just get rid of it. If you want transformation, There's no way to transform ourselves without transforming so much around us. There's no way, because most of what we call ourselves is what we have in common with others. Of all this, we have to take account, to deal with it, to know what is the secret stuff of our nature and its constituents and resultant motions, and to create in it all a divine center and a true harmony and a luminous order. And this is overcoming the psychological ignorance. He says, we can never fully overcome the constitutional ignorance unless we also overcome the psychological ignorance. These are, we're taking them as if they're separate. They're all interrelated to one another. We can never overcome the full ignorance on the surface until we realize the surface is not really the truth of our being. We're something much vaster than that. So they go together. Our psychological ignorance comes because we think we are the surface personality. I think I am my mind, my life, my vital, my physical. I don't realize that our real being is vastly larger. Our real existence, not just theoretically, not just spiritually, all the time. I'm taking in things from the world around me, from other planes, from my subconscious, from my superconscious, from the subliminal. Until I know that. So he says our surface consciousness is bound, hedged in, encircled. The ego divides us from our not, from what we call not self. The senses deprive us of wider knowledge that's available. We're identified with our body. It limits us to a particular point in time. I think I'm here now. I went to the center at 10 o'clock this morning, and from 3 hours I was here, my whole existence. I think I'm limited to this point in time and this point in space. We identify with a class, with a position, with a role, with a social identity, with a family. We limit ourselves by our beliefs, our attitudes, our values. All of this is just on the surface. To go beyond the surface, we find out we have a subliminal being. We have a conscious being that's far vaster than what we are, this tiny little tip on the surface. And it has a subconscious dimension, which the psychologists have been studying and trying. It's very murky and dark and confusing that that's the field of most psychology. We have an intraconscient, which is, or what we usually call the subliminal, an inner being that's vastly greater, where that's the plane of occultism. That's where the yogic experiences, even in the tradition, people go from the surface mind to the inner mind, or from the surface heart to the inner emotional center. That's where the chakras are. We have a vastly wider being than what we are aware of on the surface. Mother says we even have a circumconscient being. You remember that story when Mother's walking in Paris? She was kind of in a trance and she crossed the street at one time and a streetcar came along and about 3 feet, she wasn't paying attention to anything. About 3 feet before the streetcar hit her, she suddenly was pushed back because she was conscious in the circumconscient. Her circumconscient was hit before the physical body was hit. It literally threw her back because she was conscious there. And we've got the whole superconscient, which is infinitely greater than everything else. This is our being. Until we know this is our being, until we come to live outside of the surface and know the center of this being, and that's what he calls the psychic. There is a center from which we can relate to the surface, the subconscious, the whole subliminal, and the superconscious. It's the center of integration in us. Unless we reach that, we cannot come out of the constitutional and the psychological ignorance. We have discussed these in the previous chapter, but the subconscious is all that's below our present level of consciousness. There are all the physical functions of the body. I'm not deciding right now that I should take a breath, that my heart should beat even while I'm talking. All of that's going on, but there is a consciousness that's governing all of the physical processes. There is, below the consciousness, there are so many urges and impulses that we have all the time that we're not always aware of. Somebody may even come up and say, what makes you so happy? What? Why are you smiling? Oh, I don't know. I didn't think about it. Things are going on, but they're not reaching our surface consciousness. There is the sense organs that we're not even aware of that are there in the animal and the plant. But sometimes, you know, you turn around, you feel like somebody's looking at you, and somebody's looking at you. There's subtle senses. Like that. Suddenly you get a pain in the head, and then somebody calls you on the phone, and if you're very perceptive, yes, whenever this man comes, he gives me a pain in the head. You're not aware that we're receiving things that are subconscious to our perception. It comes not, I don't see somebody calling me, I feel a pain coming up in the body. Because it's below my level of consciousness. All our past memories are there in the subconscious. Everything we've rejected from the surface. Well, I used to be a very bad man, but now I'm good. I used to want to abuse people, but now I don't do it anymore. I had a strong urge to lie to people, but now I'm very honest. It's all there in the subconscious. We've simply put it back in the closet for future use. Mother tells that story of the servant that she raised as a child, educated her, she became so cultured and everything. She went to France and lived with a family there. She was very successful there. She came back to Pondy, and she's wealthy, but she came back to Pondy, and the people started complaining she's stealing. And mother called her, and she says, yes, what can I do? My old urges have come back again. In spite of the life that you can imagine Eliza Doolittle after being called a Hungarian princess, whoever marries her will certainly find out the flower girl is still there, even though she speaks so nicely on the surface. All there in the subconscious. He says, the subconscious supports all in us that refuses to change. So we know that it's a pretty substantial thing. Changing the subconscious is not possible for the mind. And the psychologist knows this. It's not even possible for the yogi who's still in the mind. Changing the subconscious can only be done by the supermental force. Until you reach the supermind, the subconscious can be controlled. It can be purified to some extent. To some extent, so we don't have the dreams that we used to have and things like that. But still things will be there because the subconscious goes all the way down to the inconscient. Until we reach the level of consciousness which he calls supermind and bring that light and that power down. And that's what Mother describes in Agenda. She describes, and Sri Aurobindo describes in Savitri, the bringing of the supramental power down into the subconscious, not only our subconscious, because there's no personal, it's not personal, it's universal. We have our own personal cellar, let's call it, or basement, but it's connected to, if you try to get to root out an anthill, you'll find out they've done a lot of studies, Janani gave me stuff on it. There are anthills that go for hundreds of miles in all directions. They're connected with all the other anthills. Our subconscious is like that. You think you're going to get rid of the termites under the house, but in fact, you'd have to clean up the whole of Madras in order to fully get rid of it. That's the subconscious. It can't be done by the mind. But we can become conscious of it. We can become conscious of its influences long before it's fully transformed. But ultimately, it can only be transformed when we get out of the other ignorances. They're all interlinked with each other. The subliminal, which he calls the intraconscient, that which is behind, where the inner mind, the inner vital, the inner physical, we have a vast intelligence, a vast capacity for senses. We have a vast capacity for vital action, for power. All of that's in the back. All of that's subtle. All of the growth of our surface personality comes from bringing forward the powers that are there in the subliminal. Some of you remember the story of Edmond Dantes in The Count of Monte Cristo. He's an ordinary good boy. Maybe 23, 24, he's a good sailor. He's a very nice boy. He's a very affectionate son. And he's deeply in love with Mercedes. He's the number two on a sailing vessel. The captain is dying. And the captain asks him, as a last wish, you have to follow the instructions of the captain. It's a law of the sea. So he says, please stop at the Isle of Elba and deliver this letter to Emperor Napoleon, who is imprisoned there. He has no choice. He has to do it. He goes and gives the letter to Napoleon. He comes back. The captain dies. The owner of the ship promotes Edmund as captain. It's a fulfillment of a lifetime for him at this age to be captain of a merchant vessel. He goes and proposes to Mercedes, and they're to get married the next night. He's got a raise. He's got everything. He's got this letter that Napoleon asked him to deliver, which he's obliged to do. At his very wedding feast, he's arrested, put in prison. For 6 years in isolated confinement in the island prison, on the verge of starving himself to death because he can't bear to live this hell any longer. And at the last minute, before he's going to kill himself just by starvation, he hears a digging sound nearby, and a stone moves, and the man from the other cell comes and contacts him. It's this Abi Faria, very, very knowledgeable, wise old man who's been in prison for so long. They all call him a madman. He makes him a son. He gives him all this knowledge, vast knowledge, not just the knowledge of phonetics, knowledge of life, knowledge of people, knowledge of psychology, knowledge of society, everything. And then when Faria is on his deathbed, he gives him the map to this fabulous treasure, and Edmund escapes from the prison and becomes the Count of Monte Cristo, one of the wealthiest, most powerful, most influential people in the world of Europe at that time. It's a fancy story. It's a perfect story of the powers of the subliminal coming to the surface. Every person, it happens to every devotee, every devotee, when they come to Mother, when somehow their surface existence gets cracked or broken in some way, hopefully not by having to go to prison, but however it happens, by whatever way, and the potentials begin to come out on the surface, and we look back 5 years later or 3 months later or whatever it is and say, we can't believe this is the same life as that life. As Edmund was completely transformed, He wasn't transformed into somebody else. He was transformed from the surface to the power that was there in his depths. And that story really makes sense when you understand that he needed to go through this in order to break out of the surface and discover the capacities that were there in his depths. It's just from a pygmy to a giant. He's always a good pygmy, a nice pygmy, handsome, nice, affectionate pygmy, but compared to what he becomes, there's no comparison. Last month, Appa asked me to write about all my experiences of the last 30-40 years, and when I started to do it, I had exactly that feeling that everything that happened that was a difficulty for me was only to move from the surface to the depth to bring out the potentials. You've all had the experience, and we know what it means. Those potentials are there in the subliminal. Whether it's the genius who taps the knowledge that's there in the subliminal, or the ordinary man who becomes as powerful as Napoleon, he has the vital power that's there in the subliminal, or a tremendous physical power of the athlete who breaks all the world records and all, that's there in the subliminal. If the subconscious is the basement of our where we live, a vast basement which we don't know down, goes down 20-30 stories below and it goes out in all directions. The subliminal is like we're living in a small room and there's one door there, we don't know where it goes, the front door, and then there's a back door. The back door never opens and we don't know where it goes. And one day the back door opens and you find out that your little shed is the guardhouse for the palace. And the whole palace is back there. And you've been living in the shed, but really the palace is yours. That's the subliminal. And there's a circumconscient around us. Unless we gain a mastery of the subconscious and the subliminal and the circumconscious, we cannot overcome the psychological ignorance. Unless I know what comes from outside. Sri Aurobindo describes one experience when he's sitting on the third floor and he suddenly feels a stream of anger coming up through the floor. He literally sees the stream and feels the stream of anger coming up through the floor and entering his body. And he understands who's coming. He knows exactly who's coming. And 5 minutes later, this man comes in who is very angry. That's from the subliminal. When you have mastery over the circumconscient, Mother tells that during the cyclone, terrible cyclone in Pandi, she rushed into Sri Aurobindo's room to shut the windows because the rain shouldn't come in all over. He's there sitting writing at the desk. Windows are all wide open on both sides, and there's not a drop of wind going into the room, let alone water. Because the power of his presence is so powerful in the circumconscient. It's not that it's not affecting him. It can't come into the room around him. And Mother says that atmosphere of peace was there for 30 miles around Pondicherry. That's the power in the circumconscient. So we have the full power only when nothing can enter our atmosphere that we don't sanction. We don't even know what's entering the atmosphere. We think it's ourselves. Only when I speak, I don't even know where it's coming from. We have to be conscious of it. We have to get a mastery of it. And then there's the superconscient. With all the planes and levels, which he's going to discuss in the subsequent chapters, the best way for me, I think about this is, imagine Elizabeth Bennet being in the room here and like us being told, you are only a character in somebody else's story. Why don't you wake up and know yourself? You're really Jane Austen. But you think you're a character in one of Jane Austen's many stories, out of the many characters that she's... Your problem is you're identified with this body at this point in time, this mother, this father, this personality. You're proud of your intelligence or your beauty or your courage or whatever else it is, or your dresses, whatever else it is. Your real job is to learn that you are the author of all the stories. What must she do? How will she behave? What will she think? That all these characters in all the stories are parts of you. That it's not just these stories, so many other stories. How many stories you want? You are creator of all of these stories. You are not limited in time. You're not limited in space. You're not limited by a particular character, by particular impulses, by particular class or caste or anything else. You are the creator of the whole world in which you live. What is the distance we have to travel in order to move from where we are to the reality of our being? For her, Jane Austen is the original ignorance. She's the absolute. We have talked about Morris Goodman, who crashed the plane and had such severe injuries that the doctors, he was paralyzed, he couldn't breathe. Three of the vertebrae and so many bones in the body were broken. The doctors told in his presence, because he can't speak or communicate or anything, the doctors told his relatives in his presence, anyway, take your leave of him, because within 3 days, we can't keep him alive for more than 3 days. And then the man communicated with his sister by blinking his eyes, and she understood them. He's awake. He's hearing. He wants to tell her something, and finally figured out using a dictionary she could get him to spell letters, and he said, I'm walking out of here within 12 months. And he did. And he's still walking today and speaking. He became famous. Where did that power come from? We say, oh, God is great. He was a faith man of faith, obviously. You don't do this based on your personal conviction. He did have a faith. Where does that power come from? If the power of Edmond Dantes to become the Count of Monte Cristo came from the subliminal, the power that made, that physically, not just psychologically, physically changed and restored the body, the physical body of Morris Goodman, so that he could, it comes from the superconscient planes. He may say it's Christ, or he may believe in any God or anything like that, but the point is, there is a power. There is a power up there that can not just change our thoughts, not just change our character, not just dissolve our reactions, not just bring prosperity. There is a power that can reform the physical all the way down into the physical level. And that's what Sri Aurobindo calls the supramental force, the supramental consciousness, because it's that consciousness that became involved and created the physical than the material. And for the divine life, that's the consciousness that should come down. It's the superconscient itself is a universe with so many levels to it, which he's going to discuss in the subsequent chapters. But it's that force from the supermind that should come down and act in our lives all the way down to the physical transformation. And that's what Mother's describing in the agenda. She describes her personal experiences of the supramental force coming down into the cells of her body and converting pain into ananda. Converting an illness. One minute there's an illness, the next minute it's gone. One minute the eyes can't see, the next minute there's perfect vision. One minute the ears can't hear, the next minute she hears with perfect clarity, but she says it depends who's speaking. Because some people she can't hear at all. That's the force even at the physical level. So the super conscient we have to come back to. That's a big plane. And this is all just the psychological ignorance. But in getting over the psychological ignorance, we're already well on our way to getting over a lot of other things as well. So though we take them in succession, they're all related. Then is the temporal ignorance. When Elizabeth tells Darcy, you're the last man on earth I would ever marry. Clearly we know now, he didn't know and she didn't know that she was ignorant of what's going to happen in time, even of what she's going to do in time. When Darcy decided that it was not proper for Bingley to marry Jane because she comes from too low a place in life, clearly he didn't imagine that 3 months later he would be proposing to Jane's sister. And what an untenable position he's put himself in. Darcy's at a much higher level of society. And he finds out that until he reverses his interference with Bingley and Jane, he can never marry Elizabeth. He's really in the temporal ignorance. When Darcy comes really probably with the intention to propose to Elizabeth a second time at Lambton Inn, and she finds out that Lydia has eloped with Wickham, and she tells Darcy, my sister has eloped with your worst enemy. And he says, well, madam, I have stayed too long. I will leave you. She is sure she'll never see him again. She's sure this is the end. She's in the temporal ignorance. But our temporal ignorance goes way beyond not knowing what's going to happen tomorrow or what happened yesterday. We think that this is our life, that this is our existence, and that those who have finished this life, it's over for them. And in the next chapter after this, there are two chapters on rebirth. And Sri Aurobindo is going to explain there why rebirth is not a wishful thinking. Rebirth, whether it's necessary for us or not, rebirth is necessary for the divine. Because the spiritual evolution necessitates a progressive development of souls and manifestation through souls in a succession of births. And that is necessary. And therefore, when we come out of the temporal ignorance, we really discover that we have a persistence in time that is unending. There is no end to our existence in time. In the tradition, there was a belief that even those who believed in a soul, in a jivatma, that the jivatma, when it goes back into the paramatma, it dissolves and disappears. And Sri Aurobindo said that's an option because the divine is free to do anything, and if the soul, as a divine soul, wants to disappear back into... But that's not the destiny of the soul. The soul is not only infinite, the soul is eternal. It's an eternal expression of one of the aspects of the divine being. We have a persistence in time. But that's not all. We are not only immortal because our soul goes from birth to birth to birth. We are immortal because the truth of our being, the reality of our being, is something that was never born and never will be born. It is a timeless, eternal existence, and we can experience that. We can experience our succession of births in time through a series of lives and know that and have that knowledge, though Mother says 99% of what goes for recollection of past lives is just imagination or superstition, because that's not what the soul retains, the kind of knowledge the soul retains. But Mother had that knowledge and gives many incidents in her stories about when she saw a comb she had used 2,000 years ago. But that most of that is just imagination. But beyond that, we can know even now that the truth of our being is something that's never born and never ends. It's a timeless eternal. We can realize our immortality. Our immortality is already a reality in the sense that we are the timeless immortal. Whether we know it on the surface or not, we are that even now. We live also in a time immortality, but that's what the soul knows. If we realize the soul, we will know it has the knowledge of a succession in time. But that's not the immortality he's talking about. When he says in the first chapter, God, light, freedom, immortality, he's talking about even the immortality in the physical. He's talking about the whole destiny of the manifest, the spiritual evolution is the reason why physical form was created, the reason why a soul is evolving in a physical form is matter also is Satchitananda. Matter also is spirit. And the destiny of the spiritual evolution is that the soul will be able to inhabit a material form and change that form at will, and that form will be an expression of the spirit, not as it is now an expression of clay and silicon and all of the other things, water and all of the things that go into it. So there is a real, we are already immortal at one level. In another sense, we're very mortal. But the destiny, the spiritual destiny is an immortality that will be true in life, on earth, in the body. And that's what happens when Elizabeth Bennet really realizes she's Jane Austen. And she can become anything she wants to become in as many stories as she wants. So that's the temporal ignorance. We overcome the temporal ignorance when we know the immortality of the soul and the timeless immortality of the pure existence behind. And then there's the egoistic ignorance. Now, if we've gotten to all of these others, by this time, there won't be much left of the ego. When we've overcome the constitutional ignorance and we've reached the psychic deep inside, when we've reached the superconscient and know the divine planes above, when we know that we're universal, there won't be much thread left. The problem is when you skip all of these other steps and try to go straight to moksha, the ego remains very much intact, because who's trying to get that liberation? Who's trying to aspire for freedom for himself? It's an ego. The ego itself is trying to do yoga for its own fulfillment, when in fact its fulfillment lies in discovering its universality, its oneness with everything. It's oneness even with the transcendent. We've talked many times about how overcoming the egoistic ignorance, and I think we all know how difficult that is. The simple one of the many things we've talked about is taking the other man's point of view. Taking the other man's point of view doesn't overcome or dissolve the ego. But even to do it for 1 minute at a time and concede that that person who wants to do exactly the opposite of what I want to do or is insisting on a point of view exactly the opposite of my point of view, it's the first step in a long journey to move from the egoistic ignorance to dissolving the ego. Non-reaction. As long as I'm capable of reacting to anything, for whatever reason, I know I'm in the ego. I told that story earlier about Krishnamurti when he was talking to a group in America, and somebody came up after the talk and told him that I have dissolved the ego. And Krishnamurti looked so surprised. Really? You have dissolved the ego? He looks a little skeptical or disbelieved. You have dissolved the ego? Yes, I have dissolved. You have dissolved the ego? Yes, I've dissolved the ego. And he, then what's shouting at me and who's angry at me now? Not so easy. We know not to react. Not to react when people don't do what we want them to do. When people don't recognize us, don't recognize our importance, don't please us, don't do anything for us, we know not to react at any moment is so difficult. Where's the question of appreciating the other person's point of view? To have goodwill for everybody, how difficult it is. You're saying, I should be happy, he got the raise, I didn't get the raise. To feel... The beauty of the story is that Charlotte feels so happy that Bingley is dancing with Jane and Bingley likes Jane. And because of that genuine goodwill that she had for Jane, she's the first one married, not Jane. Jane has to wait a year. Charlotte, who felt goodwill for somebody else to get married, is the first one married. That's the power of the goodwill. A few months ago, I told the story that Chandrasekhar had told me about the boy who was starting off in a business as a selling saris. He didn't even have a shop or anything, no? And he went to his first customer and wanted to sell some wedding saris for 1,200 rupees. And the lady that was the people from Hyderabad, and the lady said, I'm sorry, can you take an advance because we don't have enough for the whole 1,200 rupees. Then the man said, how much do you need? He said, we need 7,000 rupees for the wedding. Well, Adam, I have 7,000 rupees is my total capital for this business. They said, we have a property in Hyderabad we've been trying to sell. If we sell it, we can repay the loan. He gives the whole 7,000 to his first customer. And today that man is the owner of Nelly Silks, which is worth about 500 crores or something like that. He has definitely discovered a secret of overcoming the egoistic ignorance, and what is the power of doing that through that astonishing capacity for self-giving, which is difficult even in imagination to think of doing what he did. So we know how to do it. Goodwill, self-giving, non-reaction, taking the other man's point of view. And that brings us, we're getting close now. Now all we have to do is overcome the cosmic ignorance, meaning we have to know, even when we know we're universal, even when we know we're identified with everyone else, that that's not the whole of our existence. That we are not just in this world, we are not just the manifestation. We are, and our destiny is, that we are expressions of the divine. The individual, the universal, and the transcendent are three aspects of one reality. We think God is up there and we're down here and somehow he got the lucky job and we are stuck here. We are three aspects of one, the real, the absolute. Brahman is expressing as three, but it's only one reality. We have to overcome that illusion that somehow we're down here and the good stuff is up there. We have to discover the divine in the universe and the divine beyond the universe, and we must discover that we are that. That that is the truth of our being. This, through overcoming the cosmic ignorance, we reunite the one and the many. The world is not an illusion, it's not a maya, it's not a bad dream, it's not an endless cycle of suffering. It is the manifestation of one. The finite is the frontal appearance of the infinite. It is the mutable Brahman, is the expression and creative expression of the immutable Brahman, just like Jane Austen's stories are the manifestation of her creative consciousness. We have to know that we exist outside of the world, beyond the world. We are the timeless eternal. But becoming the timeless eternal is not the truth of our being. We are not just a timeless eternal, because if we're a timeless eternal, then obviously the rishi who's seeking moksha is right. This is all secondary. This is all just a preparation. The goal is to get to that timeless immortality and merge back. The truth of our existence is what he calls the omnipresent reality, or what he calls the absolute. The original ignorance is to know that we are, that the divine is also the world. The divine is what's transcendent to the world. The divine is beyond the one and the many. It is an integral reality which is simultaneously both. It is the integral reality that is creating, it is becoming at every moment the universe, and is always infinitely greater and free from all that it creates. And our destiny is to position ourselves on that borderline, which he calls the Supreme Ishwara, which at every moment is manifesting universe, manifesting through this process of creation, capacities of its divine nature. And when we become that, the Ishwara is born in the individual. And then we get the vision that the goal of the spiritual evolution is not a round trip back to the oneness from which we started. The goal of the evolution is the Ishwara should be born in millions of individuals and manifested in millions of bodies. The individual should also recognize and know itself as an expression of that one. And then we have a divine life, and not just a return to a oneness. And a divine life is only possible if there are divine beings. And that's why he says our destiny is to become divine, not just to worship the divine. With that, we overcome the original ignorance. We discover the truth of the absolute, which is translating itself into the relative at every moment in everything that happens. And though that's the ultimate discovery for us, when we discover that, what do we discover? We discover at every moment everything that happens, every person who comes, every event, every word that we hear, every sound, everything that happens in the world around us is an expression of that evolutionary intention. And when we are conscious of that, we know exactly what to do at the next minute for what? For the next step in the evolution that will bring that spiritual, that divine manifestation in the world. Because when we reach there, the only thing, there's no ego left. The thing left is a center of the divine, a unique center of the divine, uniquely playing its part in a divine play, with all the knowledge and all the power to do that. And there we overcome the practical ignorance. We have all the knowledge, all the power at every minute to do what we should do for the next step and the self-expression of the divine play, of the divine evolution. We started on the calls reading Davin's stories of Inspector Sambhu, Detective Sambhu. If we have all, I think, become amazed beyond measure at the brilliant knowledge that's there in Jane Austen's novel, and we've been wondering for so many years, how could a young girl at 19 or even at 28 have written a story with such a profound insight into life? The same knowledge is there in Davin's Detective Sambhu. Through the behavior of a stupid man who borders on idiocy. And when you see it, what Davin understood when he wrote the story is, I don't know, we can't even conjecture whether he was just writing entertainment or not. We don't know, we can't ask him. But when you see the story, you'll see what a profound wisdom was there. The story we took up, the first story, is called Inspector Gopalan. And in the beginning of the story, the inspector, who's an old friend of Sambhu, now Sambhu is a very famous detective. He solves so many crimes through his own idiocy that Gopalan always relies on him to save him and get him out of any situation. So Gopalan comes to him and says, "You must have a car." And Sambhu says, "That's good. Yes, I should have a car." The next thing we know in the story is that a diamond merchant has gifted a car to Sambhu, feeling the pride of having gifted a car to this great man who's so famous, and also given his driver on loan to Sambhu. So you use this driver, and whenever you're not using him, you can send him to me. And Sambhu feels very intimidated by this driver. Of course, he's a coward. Sambhu's a coward, so he can be intimidated even by his own shadow. But this driver is able to manipulate him, and when Sambhu says, "Let's go to the beach," the driver says there'll be heavy traffic or bad weather today or the car is not well. He can get Sambhu to do anything he wants as if he's the owner of the car when he's not. But Sambhu's son understands driver is only a servant and I can get him to do what I want. So his son is flying a kite and the kite gets stuck on the roof. And his son calls the driver and says, "Hey, go up and get that kite for me." He says, "What do you think? I'm a monkey? How can I go climbing? I'm only a driver." "You do it, otherwise you'll be gone tomorrow." Driver is furious. He goes up and gets the kite and breaks it all in pieces. The boy comes crying to his father. His father's not willing to reprimand the driver. He feels a little intimidated by the driver. So he says, "It's all right, don't worry, we'll get you a cricket ball and bat." It's all a silly story, no? So Sambhu's wife says, "What? No, cricket ball and bat? Somebody will get hit in the head with a cricket ball." Sambhu says, "No, don't worry about it," and he gets him the cricket ball. And then the story goes on. This is all just the warm-up. And the story is about there's a jewel thief who's stealing diamonds everywhere. And finally, he even steals the diamonds of the diamond merchant who has given Sambhu the car and compels Sambhu to try to find the criminal and get the diamonds back. And Sambhu, having taken a car from the man, feels obliged to perform, even though he has absolutely no idea what to do or where to find the criminal. And finally, he suspects that the jeweler himself is the criminal who's been stealing because he finds a handkerchief on the scene of the Gopalan is found the scented handkerchief on the scene of the crime, which is exactly like the jeweler's handkerchief with the same smell. So he's going to trap the jeweler into confession. So he tells the jeweler that he wants some jewels for his daughters or for some celebration or something, and asks the jewelers to bring his jewels there. And Gopalan is there, the jeweler is there, and opens all the jewels. And then Sambhu sees the driver standing in the corner there, and he says, "What are you doing inside? Go outside." And the driver pulls a gun. He said, "You all fools. I am the thief." He's been driving Sambhu around. He's been listening to Gopalan telling all the places that were stolen and where who's got. He's been following. He's been taking the diamond merchant everywhere where he's selling the diamonds. And I'm going to take your jewels also. I have fooled all of you. And this Sambhu is such a fool, I'm not even going to bother with him, but Gopalan, I'm going to kill you for trying to track me down. And just at the moment he's trying to fire his gun at Gopalan, the boy's cricket ball, he hits the cricket ball, it comes through the window and hits the driver on his head and knocks him down. And that's the end of the story. What a preposterous, ridiculous story. Even you can't imagine something more far-fetched than this. But when you really study the story, you'll see it has all the genius of Jane Austen in it. It has all the truth of life in it, all the principles of life we've studied. Chandru pointed out yesterday, the first feeling of Sambhu about this driver is, I'm afraid of him. He had the subconscious knowledge. This man's a thief. He's capable of killing me or my friend. He's afraid. He's a coward. He had the subconscious knowledge of that. The boy never pardons the driver for breaking the kite. If the driver hasn't broken the kite, the boy never would have gotten a cricket ball. So it's the driver who, by breaking the kite, by his over-assertiveness, he's very triumphant. Each time he steals jewels, he writes a message glorifying, thank you very much for these beautiful jewels. They're even nicer than the ones I stole yesterday. He's gloating. We've seen what happens when Mrs. Bennet gloats. The moment you triumph, you know things are over. He wants to be recognized as a great thief. He has broken the kite, thought he could get away with it. The boy was so angry with him, waiting for a revenge, of course, not knowing it. The boy's mother is afraid that this cricket bat is very dangerous. The cricket ball may hit somebody in the head. She has a subliminal knowledge. Sounds fantastic. Sounds silly. But the story has that. So what looks like just a silly story from beginning to end, when you really examine it, you see all of the patterns of interaction which we've seen in Pride and Prejudice and you can see in Shakespeare's literature and anywhere else. Whether the man had the conscious knowledge of what he was doing or it was a subliminal knowledge which he just wrote out, if Damon were here today, whether he would deny it vehemently and said he was just making things up, it doesn't matter because it's true to life. And if he had that vision, did he have that vision in his own life? If we really get rid of all these ignorances, if we really reach and the practical ignorance goes, we will understand that about everything that's happening in our life. Everything that's happened in the past and everything that's going to happen, and see it not as life coming and rewarding me or abusing me because there's no punishments and there's no suffering when the ego is gone, and when you universalize, you'll see it the next step in the divine plane. You'll see it the next step in a live spiritual evolution in which spirit is manifesting itself at every moment. And of course, is manifesting delight in everything it does, the way we feel when we read Davin's stories or Pride and Prejudice. This is the process that leads to conscious spiritual evolution. That is our destiny. Now we're unconscious of spirit. We're unconscious of spirit, let alone spiritual evolution. We don't know why we're here. We don't know why the world is here. We don't know why anything's happening. Darcy has no idea what Lizzie's going to say at the next moment. Everything is happening in a disconnected way, apparently, as a chaos and confusion, the way Sri Aurobindo described about our own personalities. That's what life is to us. It has no meaning. It has no significance. It has no apparent direction. And everything is going in all directions. When we come out of this, we will see that at every minute, not then, now, and at the past, at every minute from the beginning of the story, whether it's our story or Jane Austen's story or David's story, from every minute, everything is working and moving in a direction which is the process of spiritual evolution, which is leading from the creation of material existence on earth and the evolution of life and the evolution of animals and human life, and is taking us forward. Our starting point, why APA focuses on life response and understanding life, is because we can see now where we are now, we can get an insight into the significance of what's happening to it this minute. This event, this thing that's happening to me, how can I use this event to move from the ignorance to knowledge? To move out of my constitutional ignorance, my egoistic ignorance, my psychological ignorance, my temporal ignorance, my cosmic ignorance in all respects. And for that, the greatest endowment that we can have is what Mother calls sincerity. Sincerity never explains to us. Mother once defined sincerity as each part of the being in its right place in harmony with all the others, doing what it was meant for. The mind, the vital, and the physical, and all the others, each have a role to play in the development of the being and in our spiritual evolution. When she asked the body not to seek comfort, or the vital to take interest in everything it does, or the mind to be aware but not to believe in its appearances, she wants those parts of the being to serve the deeper intention that they're meant to serve. They are surface manifestations of the psychic being. They're there as instruments for the psychic. They're there as instruments for the higher consciousness above, the supramental consciousness. That's why when we decide not to take initiative, Appa writes about it so often, or when he asks us to follow silent will rather than expressing and asking. What he really wants us to do is not to have silent will. He wants us to give up our will. Because our will is the will of the ego. Our will is the will of the ignorance. And the method he gives for that is consecration. Consecration is at each moment to remind ourselves that we are here with all the ignorance and everything else, with a divine destiny, to move in a divine direction. And we can move in that direction at every moment in everything we do by consecrating our act, not to the comfort of my body or the satisfaction of my vital or the self-importance of my ego or anything else, but to consecrate that act to the divine. And Mother says the power for that is the power of sincerity. To remember at each moment what our purpose is, what the truth is that we're seeking. And she's defined sincerity in many ways. And there's sincerity at every part of our being. He says, spiritual sincerity is an inner psychic condition in which we're open to grace. At any moment, what should act in our life? Is it my energy that should act? Is it my intention that should act? Is it my motive? Is it my prejudice? Is it my opinion? Is it my attitude? Is it my preference that should act? At each act, what should act is the grace, the highest spiritual. To be in an attitude or a consciousness where that's what I want. What I want at the next moment is not my lunch, I want grace. And then he speaks of psychic sincerity. At any moment I'm in contact with my hungry stomach, my tired body that's standing or whatever it's doing, or my sore voice, or my eagerness to go and do something that I said I would do somewhere else. At every moment, can I be in contact with Mother's consciousness? Can that be real to me at every moment? He speaks of mental sincerity. There is a sincerity in the mind not to generate, but to be receptive to knowledge at every moment. Something happened. There's something I can learn from this. And we know that, like Mrs. Bennett's aspiration brought all the husbands that her daughters needed to our aspiration for real knowledge, not my aspiration to get the knowledge that's going to get me a prize or to prove that I'm right and somebody else is wrong. The real truth, the mind's aspiration for truth opens us to a greater truth. And for the mind to want to know what's true and not what proves I'm right or what's beneficial to me or what helps me win the argument over somebody else is mental sincerity. She says the body can have sincerity. When the body is sincere, she has a prayer of the body. Mother has a prayer to the body, to the divine, to be a faithful servitor to the divine. To want to serve the divine. She said, when the body is sincere, it feels a thrill of gratitude. It's filled with a physical sensation, not an idea, a physical sensation of gratitude that mother is there and that she receives my service, she receives my offering, whatever it may be. Abba speaks about a physical sincerity. When we're physically sincere, meaning when we treat everything the way it deserves to be treated, not because it's mine, but because it's divine, lost objects will come back, things will never break. I mentioned to Appa yesterday, I have two computers, and I was bewildered, two laptops, one a bigger, older one, and one a very light new one, which I use for travel. I said, every time something goes wrong with one of the computers, when I repair it, the other one has a problem. So I'm giving attention to this computer means I'm showing my responsible attitude towards this computer. Why should the other one go wrong? He said, oh, they're jealous of one another. Mother says even the rose flowers are jealous of having other flowers in the same vase. They only want roses in the vase with them. But then it occurred to me. Then it occurred to me. I'm repairing these computers because they're mine. My motive in is not, I'm not worshiping the divine in the computer by giving it attention. I'm worshiping my computer because I want my computers to be all right. And the computer is offended that I don't value it for its own sake. I value it as my possession. That's physical sincerity. Physical sincerity. I take care of everything. I don't allow anything. I don't even allow people to borrow things. That's only selfishness. Physical sincerity to the computer would be if I know somebody else can use this computer better than me or enjoy it more or take care of it better, I give the computer to somebody else. That's the physical sincerity to the computer. I don't have that. I was all amazed when the jeweler is giving a car to Sambhu. What a generosity. It's not a concept we've even heard of in the West that somebody should give a car. I asked Chandru, do people really here ever, anybody have that type of generosity? There is a generosity in India I've never seen or heard of outside. He says that gratitude is an emotion of the psychic. Mother says, you know, gratitude is not born on earth. You know that, remember that story she's told? All the virtues were invited to a party and then suddenly some strange woman came in and who is this? We've never seen her before. It's gratitude. Gratitude is not a human emotion. Gratitude's an emotion of the psychic. And he says, sincerity makes gratitude possible. Sincerity to mother is to be a... Yes, Ashok.
See, in the Count of Monte Cristo, when life wants to make Dante a count and the owner of a big wealth and all, it puts him through a very severe imprisonment and where he almost comes to the point of dying. It is through this severe physical punishment of imprisonment and near-death experience that he becomes the owner of a huge wealth and becomes a count. And then when we look at Lissy, she also becomes the owner of a big piece of property and wealth. But it doesn't come just like that. There is a 10-month period of waiting where she undergoes some kind of psychological anguish. To take the case of Appa himself, we see he became the owner of Jubiland property, but the property didn't come to him just like that. He had to undergo a severe court case, and he underwent a period of psychological anguish also before he was declared the owner of beauty land. So we see that when life wants to give somebody immense wealth or some kind of distinction, it invariably imposes a severe hardship by which the person qualifies for such wealth, I suppose. When we know this is a rule of life, how does Tappa so easily say, just like that, a devotee can earn 100 crores because he is a devotee? Does that mean the mother will eliminate this period of anguish and suffering that all these people have undergone by the power of her grace? I very much doubt that this could be true.
A great question. Your hypothesis is, your postulate is, that life is imposing all of these torturous conditions on us. Huh? That's what we have to question. Say, if Darcy was here, he would say, oh, life made me go through hell in order to get Elizabeth to marry me. What would she say? The very first time you met me, you insulted me and called me tolerable and said you wouldn't even dance with me.
You brought this hell on yourself. What's the sense of blaming life for that? If Lizzie says, why, I had to go through so much torture before I could become Mistress of Pemberley, that Wickham's elopement, it was almost disaster. See, through the whole story, people are warning her about Wickham. Even Carolyn warns her about Wickham. Mrs. Gardner says, forget Wickham. Darcy has told her about Wickham. She refuses to tell her father that Wickham is a dangerous man and the sister elopes with him. Who are we blaming, Ashok, for all the tortures we have gone through? We're finding somebody else to blame instead of the devil. We call it life. If it's difficult for us to come out of these seven ignorances, it's because of the famous line that Sri Aurobindo has put in the last chapter, the taste of ignorance. We enjoy the ignorance. We love the ignorance. We're so proud of our ignorance. We defend our ignorance against everything. And that's what all the stories and all our life experiences show. It's not life or mother putting us to any test. It's not the divine who tests humanity. It's the humanity decides to swim upstream when the river's going in the other direction. And so it's very difficult. Life is testing me at every minute because you want to go in the other direction. You want to go. We want to go to selfishness. I want to dominate over everybody. When all these husbands are coming to Longbourn, the only thing Mrs. Bennett's concerned is, how can I triumph over Lady Lucas? And the only thing Mr. Bennett is concerned about is that, what can I do to be sure that my wife doesn't emerge victorious? I'm not worried about marrying five girls. I'm very worried about my wife being triumphant because she'll be impossible to me to manage. It's our ignorance that causes the tension, that causes awe. That's why Mother speaks about the sunlit path. If our path through life is not sunlit, it's because we're seeking ignorance, not knowledge. We're seeking to reinforce our ignorance, not seeking the knowledge. She says, somebody, if we have the sincerity, the definition to walk on the sunlit path is sincerity. Sincerity, the way she's talking about it here. Sincerity that gives us a constantly greater opening. Not the sincerity of Mrs. Bennett, who wants to blame everybody for things going wrong, when it's quite clear that she's the one who's creating all of the trouble. The sincerity at each moment to say, what can I learn? What should I learn from this event? How can I be better? That's why we admire Darcy so much, and it's very hard to find any character in literature or in life who shows the sincerity that Darcy had. When she abuses him, you're selfish, you're mean, you're arrogant, you're boorish. I would never marry you. He goes home and says, well, you gave me a very bitter lesson. First of all, he says, well, madam, you have said quite enough. He goes and thinks about it, looks at it, says she's right, and changes himself, transforms himself. And what happens? You can say, oh, life was very bitter and difficult for Darcy. He got abused so much. But what happened? When he changed himself, when he shed the ignorance, she comes to him. She comes to Pemberley. She's standing there on the lawn when he comes back to his own house, very happy and ready to receive him and receive his proposal again. So our perception that life is testing us, maybe we should better say that we are testing life. That we are constantly testing Mother's patience by inventing new forms of ignorance when she's coming and knocking on our, and offering us to open up the door with a new opportunity to learn. Your question is the right wonderful question at the right wonderful time.
in it. The question is, are you satisfied with the answer?
I mean, Dante was in no way responsible for his imprisonment, but that's what life put him through in order to gift him all that property and the title. That's why I said like that.
I fully understand the rationality of your question. I fully understand it. Edmond Dantes, on the surface, wanted to marry Mercedes, was fully satisfied with marrying Mercedes. He thought this is the best possible thing for him. Was fully satisfied being the captain of this small vessel. He felt his life has reached a fulfillment. What was satisfied? Who was satisfied? His surface ego was satisfied. Your question presumes that Edmond Dantes is the surface ego. Your question is denying all of what Shrivindal has said. The truth of your being is not this surface ego of mind, vital, physical. You are something vastly greater than that, which Edmond did not know, which we don't know today. Edmond, on the surface, his constitution was fully satisfied. You're absolutely right. He didn't do anything to... But it's very interesting that he was brought in touch with Napoleon. Napoleon was the greatest man of his age. Life brought him in touch with Napoleon. Why? Because something in Edmond has the greatness of Napoleon. That's in his subliminal being. His real destiny in this life was not to be a captain of a ship and marry a fisher girl. She was an orphan fisherman's fisher girl. She went fishing for her living. That was not his destiny. His destiny was to be a giant, not just a physically rich, socially important man, but a man of vast knowledge and power and experience. And ultimately, at the end, he ended up marrying a princess, Haiti. A princess who was filled with devotion for him. He was very happy with Mercedes, but when he disappeared in prison, Mercedes went and married her cousin, who was actually the man who wanted to murder him. Subconsciously, Mercedes is not capable of loyalty. She did. Consciously, she was a good girl. But subconsciously, she's capable of marrying the man's murderer and living with him. So, on the surface, Edmond was willing to accept the smallest thing in life when he was really meant for something far greater. You can say that his soul came here for something far greater than this small surface existence. Mother has said that nothing can happen to us that's not sanctioned by our own soul. Clearly, on the surface, he felt that he's lost everything. But that's because he was mistaking the constitutional ignorance for the truth of his being, which we do all the time. We keep asking, Mother, give me what I want. I want this house, this car, this groom, this job, this raise, this something another. We're constantly asking her, please reinforce my constitutional ignorance and satisfy it. When the very first rule of psychic education is we're supposed to be giving this up. That's sincerity. And we say life is not cooperating and the divine is punishing us and everything's going wrong because we want the whole of the cosmos to take our point of view of our surface ignorance and satisfy it. No? That's where we starting point. That's the starting point from where we are. And Sri Aurobindo says it's not only that we're there, we love it.
We enjoy it. It's so tasty to us. We have no urge to evolve. We're quite content being where we are. That's the challenge the divine has taken up in its spiritual evolution, not to overcome just the opposition, to overcome our satisfaction with where we are. Our normal conception is that ignorance and knowledge are two opposite things. Because we have gone through so many chapters, and in my review, I've missed the most important thing, which Dr. Dev's question reflects, and that is, what is the real relationship between ignorance and knowledge? The mind thinks that knowledge and ignorance, right and wrong, are opposites. Either I'm right or wrong. But Aurobindo explains that ignorance is a limitation of knowledge. Even ignorance has a truth in it. Even ignorance has a truth in it, but it's a partial truth. When I say that when my vital says or my body says I'm hungry, I want to eat, it's not a falsehood. It's a partial truth. When mother says don't do what's comfortable for the body, she doesn't mean starve the body to death. She doesn't mean sleep on the bed of nails. When Lizzie says you're the last man on earth I would ever marry, she's wrong. She's going to marry him, but there's a truth in it. The way you're behaving now, the way you're talking now, I will never marry a man who's like this. He changes. So ignorance, our ignorance and the ignorance of the world, Dr. Dev gave a very important point. We've all known that experience. Our knowledge comes through ignorance, our own ignorance and other people's ignorance. The whole story, both the Sambhu story and this story and all the stories, are of knowledge coming out of ignorance. Aurobindo says, how can knowledge come out of ignorance? Because knowledge is already there. In ignorance. It's involved, it's limited, it's concealed. That's how life comes out of matter. That's how consciousness comes out of life, because it's already there inside. So for us, for him, knowledge is not the opposite of ignorance. Knowledge is the fullness of which ignorance is a part. Knowledge, ignorance is by definition, it's not that there isn't a truth of mind or vital or physical or of the individual or of the world. It's an aspect of the truth. Aurobindo says the only ignorance is the limitation of truth. The falsehood comes in when I say, I got the only truth. I know I'm right and you're wrong. Even what I love about the Pride and Prejudice, one of the things I like the most is, when Wickham tells Lizzie complete falsehood about Darcy, invents this complete scandal about Darcy. It is a falsehood, and she believes it. The result is it helps Darcy become a better man. How can it become? How can her, it's not just ignorance. She believes what's opposite, what was said to discredit Darcy. How can it make him a better man? Because there's a truth in what Wickham says. All the accusations he made against Darcy, that Darcy has deprived him of his living, his job, his income, and been all is false. But the truth behind his falsehood is he's arrogant. He's self-important. His behavior is offensive. And his ignorant assertion, which Lizzie believes, helps Darcy shed the egoistic ignorance which was very real in him. So when you look at ignorance not as the opposite of truth but as a limitation of truth, even when ignorance comes at us through other people, it's telling us, what's it telling us? Not they're ignorant. It's telling us our view of truth is limited. we should widen our view of truth. It is the hidden knowledge in the ignorance that's trying to come out. So it's a very important point. There is nothing, and Sri Aurobindo has a line in Life Divine where he says, it comes, I think, in the chapter on the denial of the ascetic, or the refusal of the ascetic, or the denial of the materialist. The materialist vehemently denies the existence of not only God, even of psychological phenomenon. Everything is a material phenomenon. That means goodness, truth, all of these things can't exist. The only thing that exists is material. He says that atheism, materialism, have done a great service to humanity. How can they do a great service to humanity if the spirit is really true? Because there's so much of falsehood and ignorance surrounded with our spiritual traditions. When we say that the Bible must be literally believed, the world was, you know, that Newton was actually calculating at the same time he's developing the laws of motion, he was also calculating the exact date of the earth, and he knew it was something about 6,000 years because he still believed in the literal truth of the Bible. Literal truth of the Bible. He says in that chapter in the beginning, every belief that is stated with a great vehemence has a truth in it. It doesn't mean it's not 80% or 90% false. But without a truth in it, it cannot survive. So spirituality needs materialism as its partner until spirituality really discovers the truth of its being. Like every other truth. It's hard for us not to condemn fundamentalism in all of its worst expressions, which we see. But no people and no religion has a monopoly on fundamentalism. Even the atheists can be fundamentalists in their atheism. It's fundamentalism is the falsehood, and until we give up all of our fundamentalisms, and we, I mean humanity, fundamentalism still has a role to play to teach us of our ignorance and help us come out of it. The full perfection of what we getting rid of practical ignorance is the last, but every step we take to shed the ignorance that we're in now results in greater power and greater knowledge in life. And if you take Pride and Prejudice, which you know so well, from that point of view, you see Darcy and Elizabeth and Mr. Bennett don't need to learn about the absolute and the supracosmic and the supramental or the subconscious or even the psychic in order to do much better. You see where they are in the constitutional ignorance today, where their prejudice, their self-importance, their own point of view or anything else. Whatever it is, take the next step and you will see that practical ignorance just moves away. And every devotee has seen it. Just consecrate one act. I think I've told this. Janani last year, we have our nightly calls, and she was having trouble with her internet connection, and she wasn't able to link to this web software, which we use, for 3 days. And she every day she was calling BSNL and trying to get some help, she can't even get through on the phone. And finally, on the fourth day, just as she's already dialed the number for the sixth time and not getting in, suddenly she remembers, oh, I haven't consecrated this. For three days I haven't thought of Mother. I've only thought of the... And at that second she consecrated it, the man answered the phone. She explained her difficulty, how I thought this is something they'll have to do repair, tell the computer's wrong, reinstall the software, anything else. Oh, that's your problem. Just this, let me just change this setting, and the next minute it worked. So she got the power you want over the practical ignorance. So we know the method. In fact, all the methods that we've been discussing, whether it's the other person's point of view, or self-giving, or silent will, or non-reaction, or consecration, which is ultimate, or the, all of them are going to move. The truth of the matter is, we're not really looking for the dissolution of practical ignorance, because none of us believe it's possible. We are not expecting life, because when the practical ignorance completely goes, life is divine. What we want is, we want to solve our problems. We want things to be better than today. If the practical ignorance really left us today, the world would be full of light and delight. That's not, if you're asking for that, that's great. If you're aspiring for that, that's great. I encourage you to do it. What we mean by practical ignorance is, how do I solve this problem today? I've run out of gas for the cooker, or my neighbor is, or there's too much noise, or there's no water supply, or whatever it is. No? We can, that problem of practical ignorance, any problem of practical ignorance that confronts us today, we have the power to remove today. Isn't that what Appa's been writing? Isn't that every story he's told shows we can remove any obstacle of practical ignorance impacting us on today if we're sincere, if we're willing to do what we know we can do. And he certainly not left any doubt as to what that means to do that. He said the 3-day prayer, there's nothing that can resist that. Only difference between that and what Sri Aurobindo's setting is, just because you solved that problem today doesn't mean you won't have another problem tomorrow, or it doesn't mean you won't go back and create the old problem again on the day after. For that, you have to go through all of them. So, really a good question. This doesn't mean we have a long wait. This means we have a lot to do at every minute, and every minute we can make it, we can solve the things. Thank you. Okay, thanks a lot. Thanks, Ashok. Great questions.
First of all, I am thanking Mr. Gary to deliver this speech. It's not a speech. He has given so many information and how we have to think, how we have to come out. Because we are every month we are listening to Life Divine speeches, we are getting more and more energy. And every time some point we have to be clarified, and every time it is clarified, and we are getting more and energy. And applying this in this life, we can see how we have to come out of the ignorance to knowledge. We are only speaking and talking, it's everybody, it is not possible. But we have to work on it, and any one point we have to take, like he has to... He told that stories, PNP and the Tuparim Sambhu, the Sambhu stories, how we have to change, how the spirit is working. We have to search for the spirit. We have to shed the ignorance and come to the knowledge. Then only we have to go to the path of spiritual. But we are here in the center. We have given so much opportunities to do that. And it is a very, very big boon for us. Because daily we have to do the practical things, not the theory. Now I am thanking all the audience and all the devotees. And thank you very much.